What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Premier League on OTB.
Chris Marcus Rashford back to show again. Left-footed shot. Low, and he scores! Luke Shaw makes it 2-0 to Manchester United.
The very best expert analysis on your phone and for free. Download the OTB Sports app now.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
You are very welcome back to the second hour of Off the Ball on this Sunday. Will O'Callaghan sitting in for Joe Molloy. It is time for us to review the Sunday Papers with Timmy McCarthy, former Irish basketball captain and coach and well-known commentator from the Olympic Games just gone by, and also journalist Johnny Ward. Just a quick look at the back pages today, dominated by two things really: the All-Ireland final from yesterday and Tyrone's victory against Mayo, and Cristiano's return to Manchester United, particularly dominating the British papers, but some of the Irish papers too. The back of the Sunday Independent, and we're going to be talking about Paul Kimmage's first piece of his tracking of Michelle Smith a little bit later on. But the back page is Tyrone too hot to handle. That picture of Paddy Hamsey will feature across three or four of the newspapers, that exact picture of him lifting the Sam Maguire. But that is their back page headline. We'll be talking about Joe Brawley, who's gone in particularly hard on Mayo, calling them time wasters, football's greatest time wasters even, on the inside of the Sunday Independent. But that's the back page of the Sunday Indo. The Sunday Times going for a very simple caption: just champions. Tyrone sink Mayo to pull off an improbable All-Ireland senior football title. And you've got some of the Tyrone players there in front of Hill 16 celebrating with the Sam Maguire, with the article on the front from Michael Foley, who charts how unlikely this Tyrone success was, given that 1 month ago they put out a press release saying that they will be unable to play in the semi-finals of the championship due to the extent of their COVID-19 issues at the time. But here we are a month later, after winning the delayed All-Ireland final by 5 points against Mayo. The back page of the Irish Mail on Sunday is Hand of Fate, where they're showing Niall Morgan celebrating at the full-time whistle. Contrasting emotions there with Ryan O'Donoghue, who missed the penalty against Niall Morgan that hit the post in the second half, which was a crucial moment for Mayo throughout the game yesterday. And he's a hit on the double. Dream return for Cristiano Ronaldo to Old Trafford. There was a plane protesting against Cristiano Ronaldo, which went up just before the game. So we'll talk about the duality of Cristiano Ronaldo's return to Old Trafford in a moment. Hans Sam, High and Wide, is the back page of the Sun Sport today. Again, pretty much exactly the same picture of Paddy Hamsey, which is used on the back page here, celebrating Tyrone's fourth ever All-Ireland senior football success. Also an interview with Brian Duher, and they were speaking about the fact that Brian Duher felt there was no reason that they couldn't win the All-Ireland in the first year post Mickey Hart. Good to be back again. Cristiano Ronaldo hailed an unbelievable moment as he scored twice as Manchester United beat Newcastle by 4-1. And also a transfer story about a former Republic of Ireland player in Declan Rice. Allegedly, there's a tug of war between Manchester City and Manchester United to try and sign the England holding midfielder this summer. Red Devil's Dream is the back of the Sunday World, which is Cristiano Ronaldo on his return to Old Trafford. He scored three times the last time he played against Newcastle in 2009. Just the two at Old Trafford yesterday in that 4-1 victory. And all hail the Red Hands. Again, Tyrone lifting the Sam Maguire at the end of the game at Croke Park. Mayo's crash curse continues in their pursuit of Sam. 11 All-Ireland finals in a row, which they've lost. And the back page of the Sunday Business Post is Matt Cooper, who's been looking at a variety of topics, but he talks in the bottom corner about Stephen Kenny. Remarkably very little coverage of the Republic of Ireland team. Maybe everyone's worn out after the last 10 days or so of the international window. There is a little bit about Stephen Kenny's future throughout the newspapers, but Matt Cooper saying that Kenny must deliver results soon if he's to survive. Three more fixtures to be played and the friendly against Qatar, so four games effectively will decide whether the FAI will be handing out a new contract at the end of the calendar year to potentially keep him around for 2024. So Johnny Ward and Tim McCarthy are with us. Tim, how are you getting on?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad. And we got Johnny Ward here in studio alongside me as well. Tim, if I can ask you first about Joe Brawley, because it's taken a lot of the headlines because this got spread because it was put up as an online piece last night. Joe Brawley's gone in two-footed on Mayo here. He's gone in two-footed on Aidan O'Shea after his performance in the All-Ireland final. What do you make of Brawley calling Mayo the biggest time wasters in Gaelic football?
I believe he's over the top, is my first reaction. I think that it's very easy to have a go at anybody or any team, you know, when they lose a final. And, you know, first of all, Joe's from the north of Ireland, so he'll be very pro any Northern Ireland team, and that has been evident in his commentary for many, many years. But I do believe that, you know, Mayo had a bad day. There's no excusing that. A lot of their players didn't turn up. You know, they missed opportunities. But I don't believe what Brawley said is a fair reflection of what they attempted to do. I mean, you know, they're not time wasters. These guys have put all the effort in. They're doing their best, you know, every year. As you said earlier, they've lost 11 finals in a row, which is really heartbreaking for any team, but particularly for a county like Mayo that are waiting for over 70 years. And I didn't really feel in this piece that there was anything substantive that I could say, well, actually, that's a very good point. He talks about a text from Pat Gilroy on the final whistle about culture, but he just you know, like, he just doesn't go into, you know, anything other than personal attacks on James Horan and personal attacks on Aidan O'Shea. They didn't have good days, either of them. James Horan didn't have a good day as a manager. Aidan O'Shea didn't have a good day as a player. But I just feel that he was completely over the top. And, you know, I read it, obviously, because, you know, it's a piece that's getting a lot of traction. But I think it was, you know, for the clicks. And he makes the point, Mayo's full of clicks and favourites. His culture will not change under Horan, which made Tyrone's job easy. I just think that Joe Brawley, you know, really is a lot of cliches in his piece. So didn't do anything for me, Will or Johnny. It just really was, you know, hit the guys when they're down. And I just thought to myself, there was no, you know, assessment where, if you contrast that with Colm O'Rourke's, which we'll talk about later, there was an assessment of why the game was won or lost. So not for me from Joe Brawley in this week.
Yeah, no holding back here, John. Like, just looking at some of the quotes from here, it was embarrassing and enraging, even if it was inevitable. The shame is that with a high performance culture based on merit, Mayo could be so much more than this. I got a text from Pat Gilroy, as Tim mentioned, on the final whistle. It just said culture. He called the goal chance in the 25th minute, which Aidan O'Shea was involved in, the easiest goal chance he has ever seen in an All-Ireland final. And towards the end of the piece, he said, under this manager, Mayo are time wasters, soul destroying for good footballers and good clubs, soul destroying for the people.
Yeah, I suppose the Indo is the best and the worst of its two, you know, headline columnists today. Obviously, that we'll get to talk about later on. We'll get to talk about Paul Kimmage's piece, which is absolutely fantastic journalism. And I think this is gutter journalism, to be honest, from Joe Brawley. I've had this argument before with people in the media, with a former boss actually, about Gaelic games in general, and particularly given amateur players the sort of dressing down that Brawley has given Aidan O'Shea here today, which I think is an absolute disgrace, to be honest. I think Aidan O'Shea was lucky to start the game, but James Horan decided that he was going to play him for whatever reason, maybe to use the mark, maybe to, you know, his aerial ability. I think in Gaelic football at the moment, if you don't have mobility, like David Moore and Aidan O'Shea, you kind of get found out now because it's such a quick game in terms of movement. So that's just my two cents on it. But, you know, Mayo supporters wake up this morning with probably the worst hangover of all times because, you know, the game was disappointing. But this is just a typical Brawley article where he personal attacks, as Timmy says, and he's made so many personal attacks down the years. I think he's very, very lucky to be writing in any newspaper, to be honest. It's completely out of order. And as much as you can call out James Horan, you can call out Aidan O'Shea, the manner in which he does it, I mean, typical Brawley here, where he says the name drop and text message would be a particular favourite of his, and I presume that he asked Pat Gilroy, was it okay to put in that message? So I'm presuming that the game was finally over in the 25th minute, which is nonsense, by the way. That's absolute nonsense.
The game was in the balance.
Yeah. That's absolute nonsense. Aidan O'Shea was presented with the easiest goal chance I have seen in a final. The Tyrone keeper was caught out and had left his goal empty, chasing back, fearing the worst. His life must have flashed before his eyes. He needn't have worried. Oh, for sake, the Mayo man beside me said. My brother Prunches texted me, as I said, our boy, whatever that means. And then he obviously goes on to speak about the soul-destroying nature of this Mayo team, because they're time wasters, good footballers and good clubs, soul-destroying for the people. And that's sort of a pop at the culture that the manager oversees. Mayo were responsible for arguably one of the greatest sporting, one of the greatest moments in the history of Gaelic games, really, when they dethroned Dublin, the greatest football team of all time, were dethroned by Mayo, who just refused to give up. And I feel very, very sorry for their supporters this morning. I wanted them to win the game. As somebody who lives, you know, near...
As a Galway man saying that, it's not an easy thing to say.
No, I mean, my brother spoke to me about this during the week, and he won't mind being his name being dropped from the sky either, but he was speaking to me about the WhatsApp group at home with all the lads at home, and to be honest, most of them wanted Mayo to lose. And we live nearer to the Roscommon border than the Mayo border, which would have been, which is quite important in terms of the rivalry, because there'd be more sort of animosity towards Roscommon. But there's definitely a lot of Galway fans who didn't want them to win yesterday. But I've seen the hope over the years. We spoke to, you know, Mayo fans down the years and what it means to them. You know, I when Galway won the hurling All Ireland, it was just like, it was just this massive, massive relief that, you know, I finally saw them win something and win an All-Ireland, and Joe Canning would win All-Ireland. And that day, the emotion of that day spoke to Galway fans who were crying, grown men like me who were crying. And I was on a cycle yesterday, and for some reason, the Saw Doctors came into my head to win just once, that would be enough. And I was just thinking, this is the day for Mayo. They just want that one win. And I've real sympathy for their players. I've real sympathy for the manager. I've massive sympathy for the supporters. I've no sympathy for Joe Brawley whatsoever.
Tim, when it comes to this Mayo team, and you're living just on the Roscommon side of Athlone, I saw the bridge in Athlone was lit up as green and red. I think most of the country were probably behind Mayo, which suited Tyrone perfectly. I saw a guy going in with a jersey saying, "The entire country against Tyrone, we don't care," which maybe summed up the attitude going into the fixture. But I think the story and the romance around the idea of 71 years and all that weight potentially being lifted if Mayo had lifted the Sam Maguire yesterday, particularly for that group of players having played 7 or 8 All-Ireland finals, there seemed to be a real feeling that after beating Dublin, they were on the cusp of actually doing this.
There was definitely a sense of people wanting them to win, and as Johnny said, some people with local rivals may not, but in general I think there was a feeling that they waited long enough. But sport isn't about waiting long enough, you know. You don't get anything handed to you free. There was also a sense, though, Will, that I spoke to, you know, a number of my friends in Mayo, and I didn't think they were good against Dublin. I mean, I didn't think Mayo played well against Dublin. I think Dublin imploded for whatever reason, which was very unusual. I mean, you know, they've won 6 in a row, and for them to implode in the semi-final of an All-Ireland, you know, I think maybe gave Mayo a false sense of where they were, because, you know, Mayo just kept playing in that semi-final. If you go back to that game, Dublin started the game, were in control, just lost their way, imploded in the game, and Mayo just kept going, and they just kept trying and trying, and eventually they got over the line. And maybe because of the 71-year wait, and maybe because of the desire that they have to win this Sam Maguire, this elusive Sam Maguire at this stage, that builds up psychologically, it builds up mentally in the players, and you might feel at times you're better than what you were. And you contrast that now with Tyrone. You know, Tyrone have been very quiet. They've slipped in under the radar. You know, I mean, there was a lot of talk, obviously, about the COVID situation pre the Kerry semi-final. But since the Kerry semi-final victory, there's been no talk about Tyrone. Mm. I mean, you know, all the media were talking about, and even former GAA players were talking about, this is Mayo's year, you know, because they did throw in Dublin. So I do believe that the day they played Dublin, Mayo were not as good as, you know, people in the end, you know, said. I think Dublin imploded, and I think Mayo came into this game as favourites for the first time in an All-Ireland final in a long, long time. And that's a big mantle that you have to carry, where Tyrone slipped in quietly. Yeah, Tyrone have this view, even though under current management they're changing this view of the world is against us, and I think that the, you know, and the current managers they have are not really into that. So whether it was 31 counties against Tyrone, Tyrone didn't really care. They just came in with a game plan. They stuck with their game plan, and I think for me the disappointing thing for Mayo was everyone knew how Tyrone were going to play, and Mayo didn't have a plan to perform against that. That's the disappointment, not the individual players. And as Johnny said, they're amateurs, they're doing their best, and some days their best may not be good enough.
Just to counter that, you know, the Sindo has a load of coverage on this game. Like, it's the kind of, I suppose, the celebrity stuff of Brawley, which wrongly gets the focus, really, when Billy Sheehan has an article which I thought was well worth reading. And Billy Sheehan obviously comes from a strong kind of coaching background, mm-hmm. and, you know, I spoke to a guy who's involved in coaching last Sunday about the game, and he fancied Tyrone, and he was saying that we were talking about the evolution of Gaelic football in the sense of their kickouts against Kerry, but Billy Sheehan basically says that all the Tyrone players now are able to play every sort of style of football there is. Obviously there are three cornerbacks that's, or there are three in the full back line that scored in the first half against Kerry, but basically forwards are defenders, defenders are forwards. And he spoke about the fact that Tyrone did unleash some kind of you know, left field stuff like the high ball, which obviously was so crucial for the goal, and different stuff that Mayo didn't necessarily expect. Their kickouts were the kickout stats were much more in their favour yesterday. Spoke about Conor Myler obviously as well.
But a better range of kickouts yesterday, John, which happened too.
A range of kickouts, and it's hard not to have massive regard for them, really. You know, they were so, I mean, in fairness, they're still obviously going to be question marks over the whole the COVID situation and all that, and justifiably. And I think Kerry deserves some credit in all of this, because I think Kerry were sportsmen. They wanted to play, they wanted to get to an All Ireland final the way that you know, you traditionally do. But you know, if similar rules had been applied to Rowan, it just be as applied to Sligo last year, Rowan would have been quite possibly thrown out of the championship.
And Kerry would have been perfectly within the rights if they had said there's been a date set for this fixture.
Absolutely.
You have to field that weekend.
Absolutely. Like, you know, and Tyrone kind of then started stonewalling questions on COVID, which in fairness, we had Brian Dewar on the show one Saturday. I thought he spoke very well, but they did get a bit of luck in that regard. But take that away from the equation, and just this attitude that they have, like the self-belief that they showed in that game, and the self-belief they showed against Kerry was astounding. And Joe Brawley described them as a Midland football team, which is interesting, in an article where he was basically slating Mayo. I think that's a bit harsh. Like, they have good footballers, and they've a range of footballers all over the pitch, and it was absolutely engrossing to watch. And Gaelic football is in this weird position where really only a handful of games are of any real interest all year, but when they are, everyone wants to watch it. And I got that feeling. I was down in Cork yesterday and we watched it in a bar in Glengariff, and the place, like, there were just TVs everywhere, everyone was watching it. Somehow there were Tyrone and Mayo jerseys in the arsehole of West Cork, and everyone was engrossed. And just as the game went on, the place just went really flat, because it was like, here we go again. Mayo have just somehow managed to lose again. But I thought Billy Sheehan's article was good, because I thought Mickey Hart was way too long in that job, and I think he should have been replaced. But look how quickly the change has made a difference. And I thought Billy Sheehan's article was good, because it spoke about the good coaching that they've gotten, and the stuff they brought to the game that Mayo either didn't expect or weren't able to deal with.
It vindicates in a way, Tim, the decision that Tyrone County Board made around Mickey Hart, because there was that feeling over the last two or three seasons, and 3 years ago they got to an All-Ireland final, that there was a group of players who were coming through that had potential to do a lot. There were plenty there who thought, give Mickey Hart the job for as long as he wants it. But they made that decision to have a change in management. And as Billy Sheehan writes about, and you know, there's also, you mentioned that Colm Keyes has got a piece just across from Joe Brawley talking about the young players coming through, how adaptable and well coached this bunch of Tyrone players are. It seems to have been the right decision to jettison Mickey Hart when they did.
And Shane McGrath in the Mail on Sunday talks about it as well, about the fact that, you know, it was like it's only a year ago Mickey Hart is gone, when you think of it. I mean, and Johnny's point is probably well made, that he stayed just in the game too long. But it takes courage to get rid of somebody who's in the game that long, who's been successful for Tyrone, a county had never had won until he got involved. So it was a big call for them. But I do believe that when you win it at the end, you know, we sometimes lose sight of some of the facts. Tyrone, you know, have not become a brilliant team overnight. I mean, they were very average in many times during the championship, and obviously during the league in that sense. But what they have players who can play in any position, and they have footballers all around the pitch, and that's a big thing. Also, what seems to happen is that the mentality that Mickey Hart in the latter part of his career was that the whole world was against us, seems to have not been what Dewar has brought into it. Like, he's sort of given him a bit more of a free rein, it looks like, in
Colm
that sense.
O'Rourke talks about that as well, Timmy.
So again,
Colm O'Rourke talks about that as well.
He does, yeah. And I was just going to make the point, as Colm O'Rourke said, you know, there's a loosening of the reins in that sense. What I was impressed just with Tyrone was, first of all, I was impressed the fact that they could all play football, okay, and they're all connected and committed to the same program. You know, there's nobody, like, whatever their game plan is, they're all committed to the game plan, and the game plan is obviously pace, It's versatility, it's flexibility. You can be a cornerback or a half forward within a 30-second play phase. It's also about that it's one team. And that's one thing that, you know, Mickey Hart had for many years, and definitely, you know, the Cork management have for Tyrone. It's one team and they're all focused on the same mission. And if Brawley's article has any credence, and as Jaime said, believe it has little credence, if any credence, you have to question politically, are they all connected in Mayo as they were in obviously in Tyrone? I believe they are. Mm. But what I saw yesterday from Tyrone was a connection on the floor, all driven by the fact that the county board had the courage to get rid of Mickey Hart. And when you look at other managers in GAA who are around a long time, sometimes the county boards don't have the courage. And the problem when you have managers around a long time who are not bringing new talent forward is you lose a generation. And the decision that Tyrone have now gives them a new generation instead of the potential loss of a generation.
Some of this fairly common, lads, across some of the other articles. Michael Foley's piece, which carries just inside the Sunday Times on the page 2 and 3, makes the point about the misery for Mayo. But he says what will hurt more than losing this All-Ireland final, where there was that expectation that Mayo were going to get over the hill, was the type of performance that they put in. And similarly, David Brady is writing page 69 of the Sunday World today, and he says quite simply, Johnny, that it feels like Mayo didn't show up. After a week of huge optimism and the feeling that they were going to win, a flat performance then follows.
Did he reference his tweet yesterday morning?
I don't know. I don't think it's there, but I think he was hitting back at a few people that were very quick to tweet him last night afterwards.
Yeah.
He got a bit flowery. Got a bit emotional.
Yeah, yeah. We spoke to him on OTB AM the other day, and it was half 7 in the morning, and the man was absolutely mad up for the All-Ireland final when most of us wouldn't be out of bed. And he did kind of, I suppose he embodied that yearning, you know, and it's 70 years. I mean, very few people, I'd say a handful of people, saw Mayo in an All-Ireland in the flesh were still alive. So they've known nothing in that county but heartache after heartache after heartache. And after last year, you wouldn't imagine that they went into combat in the All-Ireland this year thinking we've a chance. But the way the stars aligned for them, they just didn't perform. I mean, some people will retrospectively say that they celebrated the semi-final too much. There might be an element of that. I didn't see that, to be honest. I thought it was an occasion that was worthy of the celebration. But they just didn't really perform. And I think, take away all the stuff about, you know, mentality and showing up on the day and all that, maybe the forwards just weren't quite good enough. And I think that's a point that has been made in a couple of the articles as well. The missed penalty obviously was critical, but like some of their shooting, again, it's a traditional Mayo failing, kind of let them down. And Tyrone just kind of grew in confidence as the game went on, but it'll be a hard one for Mayo to take. And I think my own county in Galway, I think they'll be somewhat emboldened by the fact that Galway were so good against Mayo in the first half, that maybe, you know, maybe we're not a million miles away, but they just didn't really show up for whatever reason. And I've massive sympathy for Mayo fans, because it's hard to take. It was, whether you like it or not, they've all built themselves up that they were going to win this game pretty much, and they didn't.
Well, Brady says that one of the real difficulties for next year for Mayo is that Kerry in Dublin will be back with a vengeance after what happened to them in the semi-finals. The route becomes more difficult to get to the All-Ireland next year because the qualifiers and potentially, you know, Super 8 style tournament could be there, depending on what's agreed on at the upcoming Congress, and therefore the path is going to be a bit longer, and some of the teams that were knocked out over the last couple of years will get a second chance, unlike over the last two seasons. And he also makes the point within the piece that this is, in his opinion, the hardest defeat that they have suffered of any of the All-Ireland final losses since 1989. He says this one is the hardest, maybe the hardest to take. It wasn't about just being pipped to winning line by a great Dublin team as in recent years when we've been playing our best football. Yesterday we just didn't turn up for some reason, and it'll be a long, long bleak winter out west. We'll rise again in the spring, but this loss will sit in our minds for a long time. And Tim, when it comes to Mayo, maybe there will be a recycling of the team. We talk about players like McLaughlin and Keegan and Aidan O'Shea who are playing in a 7th All-Ireland final yesterday. Those players will have decisions to make. They've lost so much experience, you know, with the likes of Andy Moran retiring in recent seasons. There's some interesting young players coming through, like Conroy and like O'Donoghue, but there's some players who are probably going to be at a crossroads and will have a bit of thinking to do this winter.
There's no doubt that those players will have to make decisions. You know, age catches up with everybody ultimately in that sense. Just 2 points on the David Brady piece. I think it's the hardest defeat because it's the curtain defeat. I think if you go back to 89, you know, as a Corkman, when we beat them in the All-Ireland final, you know, my buddy Liam McHale, you know, said he was devastated after that defeat. If Jake DeMead, you know, replayed defeat, you know, they were devastated after that. So I think the defeats are always devastating at that point in time. The difference was that they went in as favourites, which was which make it harder. In the Sunday World, next to Brady's piece, though, I think Pat Spillane makes a very interesting point. They conceded one goal in the championship. Now, here's a team that conceded goals for fun in the league. Tyrone conceded one goal. And goals win matches. They conceded no goal in the semi-final against Kerry, including extra time, and obviously not in the final. That's a serious performance by a team. Now, we know they play a sweeper, and we know they play a swarm defence, but to concede only one goal in five championship games is serious. But the Mayo players will definitely have to look now, as I said, because Tyrone players are coming as a new generation. The Mayo players are a mix of the old generation and some new players coming on board. And it's unlikely that some of the older players will continue to keep going. It's just unlikely because they lost a lot of players after last year's defeat. They lost a couple of players in the seasons before that. And it's likely that, you know, players will have to look very hard at themselves and say, have I got it at this level now? Have I got the mobility that Johnny talked about earlier on? Have I got the desire to do it all again? Because David Brady did call out the second point I want to make about the fact that the qualifiers will be back next year. You know, the journey will be tougher. There'll be more games involved from that perspective. So it may not be as easy. You know, a knockout environment gives weaker teams a chance to get to a final. When you have qualifiers, weaker teams get no chance to get to a final. And I know Johnny's County Galway will be feeling that, you know, we have a chance next year, you know, when you look what Mayo did this year. So I think there'll be question marks about some of the older players. Do they want to give it another shot? Because it's not you're giving it another shot and saying, you know, we have a chance of winning. Like, this was probably their best chance of winning in a long, long time, in the sense that the big two were gone. Dublin and Kerry were gone. But the problem was, you know, they came up against a really talented Tyrone team who performed on the day, and Mayo did not perform on the day.
Well, hope springs eternal for all the teams about Sam Maguire 2022. We'll take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to be taking a look at Paul Kimmage's piece about Michelle Smith.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
You're very welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review. Will O'Callaghan sitting in on this Sunday and Off the Ball. I'm joined by Tim McCarthy and by Johnny Ward. Johnny, we're taking a look at Paul Kimmage's piece, which he flagged up when I was in the papers about a month ago, that he was going in search of Michelle Smith. That one was very much a preview to say we're going to be looking at Ireland's greatest ever Olympian in terms of medals won. But the story, of course, a lot more complex than that after 1996 and the sample tampering and the suspension she took. And Michelle Smith, like, wrote to Liveline just a few weeks ago when the Olympics were on and complained that she had been airbrushed out of history and that her medals are still very much valid. But Paul Kimmage has, for four pages across the Sunday Independent, began his profile and his look into Michelle Smith starting in the 1990s here.
Okay, so in another world, I think my dream job would be to edit a Sunday sports paper. Do you remember when they had the title back in the day?
Mm-hmm.
And I was in school at the time. I was probably half aspiring to be a sports journalist, and I loved the idea of a Sunday sports paper. And kind of eventually that came and went, whatever. But if I were to have a Sunday sports paper, this is exactly the type of article. It's a four-page spread that clearly involved a hell of a lot of work. Not only the people he's interviewed, but like, I've almost images of Paul Kimmage being in the National Library here, looking back on old articles like I did as a student, because he goes back to like the 80s and 90s, reels off the Irish Times, the Irish Indo, some of the articles of that time. But it's part one, so it's almost like getting excerpts from a book here. And it is just fantastic journalism, not only the stuff that he finds and brings up, the way he weaves in this kind of trip of Gary O'Toole and Michelle to a U2 concert in Phoenix. And this is a typical Kimmage article where he puts it into numbers, and sometimes I feel it works better than others. I think today it works unbelievably well. So there's nine numbers in nine different parts of the article. And number six is, love is blindness. I don't want to see. Won't you wrap the night around me? Oh, my heart, love is blindness. In a parked car in a crowded street, you see your love made complete. Thread is ripping, the knot is slipping, love is blindness. That was the final song played at the U2 concert that Michelle and Gary attended. in April 1992 in Phoenix, nearly 30 years ago. So I was kind of, that got me wondering, how did he know what was the last tune? How did he get this, the playlist? But it's all completely irrelevant, because she was falling in love with the coach who obviously would be so instrumental in her life, and so
her husband Eric,
Who I have to say I didn't know anything about really as an individual. I'm not mad into the Olympics in general, so I'm a bit like exactly the person that Kimmich sort of talks about here, and that has been complete omerta. It's like as if Michelle Smith didn't exist for the last 20 years or whatever. But he goes into De Bruyne's kind of background as a disc thrower, and some really, really fascinating lines about him. He dropped his father as his coach, travelled to Guadeloupe and started working with Henk Kragenhoff, a performance consultant with interesting views on supplements and nutrition. Read into that what you will.
Interesting views is quite a euphemism, yeah.
Then he started to improve. A silver at the 1989 World Student Games. He was studying to be a teacher. A silver at the 1990 European Championships. A silver at the 1991 World Championships. And gold every time the late Hans van Wissen, a journalist with De Volkskrant, sought his views. So that's brilliant journalism there. Brilliant writing. Gold and silver and all that. I am not somebody who lets himself be pushed in a certain direction. If the majority turn right, then I turn left. I used to get screwed for it. But how many people read the paper? How many read the sports section? How many of them would actually be interested in Eric De Bruyne or remember what I said? And even if they did and objected to it, would it bother me? The answer is no. In the past, I used to be shy, except in the discus ring. I am still reserved in company, maybe even suspicious. People say hello to me because I happen to be good at throwing the discus. That is no concern of mine. And then he details how Gary O'Toole met him after, I think, what was his final Olympics performance, and didn't like him at all, took an immediate dislike to him. But like really fascinating stuff about Gary, and this is when the Michael Carruth Olympics, and Michael Carruth got gold, and the Northern boxer got silver, whose name escapes me at the moment,
Wayne McCullough.
So it's effectively, they were on the plane back, and this is such an amazing image when you think about it, if it's true for the article, that McCullough and Carruth were basically told go out the front of the plane. And this is like, you know, that scramble when, like, it's one of the real really difficult moments in life when you're in a plane but you're seated somewhere around the middle, and you're taking that even money, the pair, will I go out the back, will I go out the front? So with these, and Gary O'Toole, who's so depressed at this moment, he's so depressed because all his hopes and dreams, they basically had to go out the back. They were told, you go out the back and let the winners out the front. He said he couldn't get over it for weeks. He was so down and despondent. It obviously then talks to Shane Gordon, who's a very good friend of Michelle's. They sort of swam together as young swimmers, and it obviously talks about O'Toole. It talks to O'Toole. It goes back to Michelle's youth, it goes back to her upbringing, goes back to her relationship with De Bruyne, and I have very little interest in swimming, and I enjoyed this piece from start to finish. I can't wait to read the second part next week.
It does that thing the first piece has to do. It sets the scene very nicely, and the forward sell is Golden Wonder is going to be part two. So part two is going to move from 92, I would think, to Atlanta in 96, and you get the story of the gold medals and the big performances in Atlanta is going to be part two. That's what everyone wants to read about.
Yeah, because it details that she's, now I wasn't aware of this, but it says physically she's not really a swimmer, and I think one of her early coaches told her dad she's no chance, she won't make it, she's not physically there. But she was brilliant in her early days. But the article goes on to show that she seemed to have sort of reached some sort of a plateau or limitation. But even the use of the images in the piece, there's a photo of a very young Michelle and Shane in a piece where they're kind of sharing a trophy, real fresh faced. And then, I mean, the quality of the image isn't great, which arguably adds to it.
Because I know, it's a little bit too small to show the viewers.
The passage of time, but this is and swimmers, including Michelle, Shane and Gary O'Toole, with coach George Gibney at Dublin Airport for the European Championships in 1989. And you can just imagine, you're looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 12 people in that piece. And Gibney's phase, hovering in the bottom right, and you're just wondering what's going on in those people's minds. Like, and this piece isn't big enough to go into the whole Gibney situation, but he is kind of referenced on occasion because of his role in Irish swimming. I don't think Paul Kimmage bites his tongue when he speaks about his evil nature, or whatever. But it's just a brilliant piece, as you say. It sets it up remarkably well for next week, and I'm just intrigued by Michelle Smith now. I'm just like, where, as you say, that intervention in the Olympics, like, why did she do that? Why does she feel that, you know, this never happened? She still has her medals, I guess. Great piece.
Tim, what did you make of it? There's a lot going on here and a lot of things being woven through about Eric De Bruin and his doping past, as mentioned by John. You've got Gibney hanging over the very middle piece of this. You've got a lot about O'Toole going from being, you know, remarkably talented European medalist, great hopes for Barcelona, it doesn't happen for him. And we've got the lead up to Michelle Smith going to Atlanta in 96. I think over the four pages, there's a lot happening here in this Kimmage article.
There's a lot happening, there's no doubts of that. But I love this piece, Will. I thought, it's like a box set. You get a great box set. I wanted to, you know, read the second one, not wait for a week. Like,
that's exactly
the week
it. Of a movie, yeah.
Right? That's the way, when I read it, I said, oh, God, you can't stop. So if I'm watching a series, you know, I sort of, you know, dump everything for the weekend and watch the series because I want to get everything done. This has the that written all over it. I thought he set it up brilliantly at about the Texco Awards. I just thought to myself, you know, he talked about 1999 in Dublin, right, at the Texco Awards, and for 4 years previously, she had been fated as a superstar, and for the first time ever, she's now not even acknowledged. Really, no one talks about her. You know, he called out that, you know, people like Sonia Sullivan, Darren Clarkett, says Michael Donlan, but Des Cahill and Kevin O'Flanagan were at the same table. Eric did most of the talking. She did very little of the talking. She watched the presentations. Before that, she was the supreme champion. And, you know, so there was no invitation. And I just thought to myself, whoa. So he's taken us to a point where, because, as Johnny said, many people don't even know about Michelle Smith. I mean, a lot of people in Ireland don't even know who Michelle Smith is, which is, you know, incredible when she won, you know, has the most Olympic medals of any Irish athlete in any situation. So I just thought that was a brilliant start. Then the next day I thought, I mean, I did actually enjoy the U2 tickets. I was saying to myself, geez, I'd like to sit next to Paul McGuinness on a flight sometime and get that card, because, you know, Gary O'Toole thought he was going to the cheap seats. I think it was ZZZ, and he ended up
usher forward,
Michelle Smith in the VIP situation, you know. The other thing which Johnny just briefly mentioned is she wasn't built for swimming. Now, that was a fascinating technical piece for me. So as a coach in GA and a coach in basketball, that was really a brilliant technical piece of information, that she had small hands and small feet and wasn't short, and was short at 5'3". So she was not very tall, and then her feet and hands were small, which obviously is a problem technically for swimming. But what she had was that she would go through awards. So she had a great desire in that sense. The thing that actually shocked me, because let's be very clear, Eric De Bruin, there was a question mark about him, you know, consistently. What really shocked me was the call he made about Ben Johnson. I mean, that Eric De Bruin says, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Johnson remains the prime athlete of the Seoul Olympics. He performed incredibly and fantastically. I don't care what way he's achieved this. Mm. Now, that is scary. Yeah. I just thought to myself, that is scary now. I mean, for people, you know, who were too young to remember Ben Johnson, he won the 100 meters gold medal when he beat the great Carl Lewis and Linford Christie to second and third. But he was caught for taking drugs, and, you know, he lost his medal immediately afterwards. I think it goes on history as a race that most of the people on the line apparently had taken drugs at some stage. But Ben Johnson, it was world news. This was the biggest news at that point ever in the Olympics. And Eric De Bruin calls out that, you know, he was his word was the prime athlete. This was a drug cheat. Ben Johnson was a drug cheat who was caught taking drugs. He won a gold medal illegally, falsely, and yet Eric De Bruin. So that gave us a real insight into his mindset. And Johnny made a point about dropping his father and that. The other thing I thought as well, Will, was, you know, imagine being told, go down the back. And what you're really saying, the losers go out the back door. Like, it had nothing to do with Caruta and McCullough. You know, they could still have come out first with their medals and got all the whining and dining that they deserve. But for every other Olympian to be told, go out the back door. In other words, like, we don't want you, like, you're not relevant. And I just thought to myself, not just in the context of Gary O'Toole and Michelle Smith, but everybody else, I thought to myself, that was horrific. You know, that was actually saying to people, we don't value you. You actually have no relevance to us unless you win a medal. Yet 2 weeks before that, or 4 weeks before that, they were saying the opposite to these people in that sense. So I thought that the thing then about Shane Gordon, you know, her friendship with Michelle Smith, and to me, the part I really thought was brilliant was when Shane Gordon talked about walking down to Mount Juliet, and the night Michelle Smith won her first gold medal.
Yeah.
I was just overwhelmed with joy for her. I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, Michelle, I was so happy for you. And then a moment later, she was struck by a conflicting thought. And as we're live on radio, I'll say, oh, shite.
Glad you used that phrase, Tim.
I think, Tim, you've disgraced yourself a bit there now, because that's like kind of saying this is how Line of Duty ended today, and everyone who like wanted to read the piece, you've just given the last line, because it is absolutely brilliant. It's so good. And it's hard to think, like, the Sunday Independent, this article up until recently would have been free online. Mm. I mean, and like the actual joy of buying a newspaper, you can't read this article on your phone. It's too long. This is a piece to, and there it is crackling in front of you. If you don't buy a newspaper, buy it for articles like this, because it's just, as Tim says, it's just a fantastic piece. Tim has mentioned the start and the end of it, brilliantly, brilliantly put together.
But also importantly, Johnny, the way that this piece is set out, it's set out to be in newsprint. It's very clearly formatted in a way that goes across the four pages. You mentioned the numbers that are used, the way that the pictures are actually used throughout the piece too. This is a piece that's meant to be read on physical paper.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm very much a traditionalist. I still buy the paper very regularly. I love having a coffee, you know, reading the paper, and it is so sad that a generation of people are just basically, they don't know A, how what it's like to read a newspaper, and B, they just spend their days on their phone. And it's a beautiful thing. It's tangible, you can smell it, and you can maybe leave this on the kitchen table and people can open it and read it, rather than your dirty phone or whatever. And it's just it's proper journalism, and it's kind of the centerpiece basically of the paper. It's almost like a little pull out part one, The Girl from Barcelona. There is the actual piece, and there's Michelle. And do you know what I was thinking about as well? People have done worse things in life than whatever Michelle did or didn't do. Do you know what I mean? She's still a human being. You know, and I've some sympathy for her on a human level, despite the fact you could question maybe what she did in terms of the Olympic sister. I do have some sympathy for her, because people have done a lot worse things in life. And
Michelle Smith was stressed as well, Johnny, because this discussion is going to ramp up with the piece next week. Mm. That she didn't test positive in competition, mm-hmm. and particularly for that Olympic Games, she will say those medals have been earned, and those medals are still very comfortably sitting in her home.
Yeah, and you know, she obviously has a right to tell her story. But we speak about allegations against other sports people. Like, it's Michelle's. Even whatever she may or may not have done, she's still a human being, and I do wonder, like, if she goes into the local pub, I think was the Putching Still, I recall, was always used to celebrate her success. If she went in there now, how would she be received? You know, mm-hmm. And I think she was definitely. I think this is. There's so many layers to this piece, but Kimmage. I'm just thinking of it now. He goes out of his way to show how much he was in love with De Bruyne, and love can do bad things.
Mm. Tim, before we talk about the football, what do you think about the fact that, like, you were on the Olympics coverage just a couple of months ago, and we saw all the successes of the Irish team, and you see Michael Carruth doing his box jump after he wins the gold medal in Barcelona. 96 is distinctly missing, and no Michelle Smith when it comes to the video packages that happened before the Olympic Games. She has literally been written out of Irish athletics history, really.
And she's been written out because of the uncertainty of obviously the end, her end in that sense. I mean, Michelle Smith would rightly say, you know, she was tested clean at those games. So from her point of view, she was tested and she was clean. So her medals in her view are correct. Obviously, then you had the situation, I think, with the guys, the Mr. and Mrs. Guy, and the sampling and the tampering of the sample and stuff, and then the suspension. So, you know, 2-2 became 6 then, and all of a sudden it was said, well, you know, she was never clean. She was, I think it was Janet Evans, if memory serves right, was the American swimmer who challenged her
in 96,
on the podium.
Yeah,
in 96, and you know, and so the difficulty, I think, for broadcasters, in this case for, you know, Olympic coverage, is that if you put something up, Johnny makes a point, she's a human being and she should be respected as that, but if you put something up, do you have to qualify it? So if you put up, you know, she won these medals, do you have to qualify by saying she was, you know, she's interfered with samples afterwards? I mean, you know, just, I mean, Waterford Crystal doesn't get, you know, doesn't get brought up either, if you think in the horse, you know. So you just have to be careful because of the issue that surrounds Michelle Smith. The sad thing for Michelle Smith is that if she was never taking any substance that she shouldn't have, then her career has been unfairly damaged, okay? Mm. If she has been taking them, then, you know, obviously only she knows that and the people that would have been there. But she did win 4 medals. She did win them and she was tested clean. And, you know, it is part of Olympic history. But then you had other people like Marion Jones won medals and other people over the years. And, you know, so there is a question mark. And I can understand why broadcasters would say, look, if we're going to say one thing nice about her, well, we have to qualify it. And then you end up with, you know, with a dilution of the thing. And the sad thing is that, you know, we've had, you know, I think only one person ever had a medal taken back, which was Waterford Crystal, who was actually tested positive at the Olympic Games. So, you know, so that's, you know, so for me, the sad thing is that she won 4 gold medals and she never got credit ultimately after 1999 for them. And that's sad because there's many people now who don't know anything about Michelle Smith. And yet she's won 4 medals.
I think, Timmy, people could exonerate her in the sense of if something did happen, if mistakes were made, people could exonerate her. I guess it's her defiance that people just can't take.
Yeah, I think, Johnny, that's a fair point. And, you know, but if you're Michelle Smith, why would you not be defiant? You know, you're saying, well, I went to the Olympics, I won the medals, and, you know, I was tested clean. And I just think it's a bit like we talked about Mayo earlier on, and that it just breaks your heart to think that there's a question mark about them. That's the thing. You know, we don't get a lot of good medals in Ireland. We definitely don't get a lot of gold medals in Ireland over in the history of the Olympics. And, you know, the country was in a high, and then all of a sudden there was question marks. And as you said, if she went into, I think it is the Putting still, by the way, on the Neas Road, as I was traveling off the top and on the way down. It would be interesting to see what would be said. And I think that people who would be of that era, who were around then, would just have differing views. But the reality is that irrespective of what we believe, okay, and, you know, she is in Olympic history as having 3 or 4 medals, 3 of which 3 were gold. And that's something has never been taken far from her. But then, you know, writing to Liveline, you know, was that, you know, that was her choice? Did that do her any favours? You know, many people didn't even know who she was, so it made no difference. But don't forget, Eric de Bruin said in the article, he doesn't care what people say. Mm. He said that himself in the article when you call that orology, Johnny. He made that point himself in the article. He doesn't care what people say. So for me, it's just a tragedy of Irish sport that we had somebody who won all these medals, and because of the question marks that later hung over, she doesn't get any credit for winning those medals. And, you know, that's the travesty of it. Because if she won them cleanly, brilliant, and she should get the credit. But she did win them cleanly in the testing, but she just doesn't get the credit for it. And that's a travesty. It's a travesty for Michelle Smith, and it's a travesty for us sports lovers who love sport. And, you know, as somebody who was involved in the Olympic Games and basketball for a number of campaigns, you know, you just want to do your best for your country. But, you know, her reputation was tarnished because of what happened, what was called out at the Games by Janet Evans, and what happened a number of years later. And that's sad. That's sad for Michelle Smith on a human level. Okay, because ultimately sport is only about, you know, a bit of fun for all of us at the end, it should be. Mm. It's sad for Michelle Smith on a human level that she doesn't get the credit or recognition. And I just think, going back to the piece with Paul Kimmage, he sets that up brilliantly when he talks about in 1999, at the start of the article, her fall from grace, how quick it was. And I just think, Johnny, we should always remember the fickleness of adoration in sport, right? Okay. So she went from 3 years of being the star, everyone wanted to talk to her and be with her, and then all of a sudden she was, you know, excommunicated practically from the top table and from the being fated by others. That's how fickle sport is. Aidan O'Shea yesterday, you know, and his teammates lost. If they came back and won next year, they'd have forgot yesterday. So that's how fickle sport is. And for Michelle Smith, the sad thing is that no one gives her credit. Sorry, not for, no. Most people don't give her credit for what she did in 1996 in Atlanta. And that's something she has to deal with in her journey.
Well, lads, we're going to have to talk about football the far side of 3 o'clock because we're very quickly heading towards the news at 3 p.m. Still to come on the paper review, we'll be talking about the coverage of Cristiano Ronaldo. Rootless Ronaldo lives up to the hype is one side of the Sunday Times, and on the other, protesters say we won't be silenced. Those were protesting against the ongoing civil case against Cristiano Ronaldo. Accusations of rape which were made against him in 2009 haven't gone away, and a plane was flown above Old Trafford with the message "Believe Catherine Mayorga" just before the game was due to kick off at Old Trafford. So we'll be talking about that just the far side of 3 o'clock. We'll also be looking at the coverage of Stephen Kenny, which has died down a little bit compared to Monday or Tuesday of this week, where the claims are being made that he had very little chance of getting a contract renewal if Serbia were to beat the Republic of Ireland in the World Cup qualifier on Tuesday night. Paul Roan's piece today claiming potentially there could still be a contract for Stephen Kenny at the end of the upcoming 3 World Cup qualifiers and that friendly against Qatar. We'll talk about that and also bring you a bit of Jonathan Hill from during the week, the FAI CEO who spoke about Stephen Kenny's situation. And we'll talk about Gordon Elliott, who is set to return to racing having served his suspension, and the owners who have stayed loyal to him. We'll talk about Dennis Walsh's piece, which is in the Sunday Times around him, and also Leona Maguire, probably the most celebrated Irish female athlete of just the last little while. She's going to have a hell of a competition with some other female athletes like Rachel Blackmore and Kelly Harrington when it comes to Sports Person of the Year. But her perseverance and the way she played under pressure at the Solheim Cup also across the papers today. We'll discuss those stories after the news at 3.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
You are very welcome back into the Sunday Pay-Per-View. Will O'Callaghan sitting in for Joe on this Sunday afternoon. Johnny Ward is with me, and so is Timmy McCarthy. We're going to talk about a lot of the football stories in the papers now. Just to give you a taste from what's been happening with the dialogue around Stephen Kenny before we look at the writing in the Sunday papers about the Republic of Ireland boss. Earlier this week, our reporter Stephen Doyle caught up with Jonathan Hill, the FAI CEO, and he asked him directly about Stephen Kenny's position and whether he is the backing of the association.
Jonathan, just to ask you first, Stephen Kenny was asked last week about his position as the Ireland manager. There was talk of him being under pressure, possibly could lose his job if the results in the last international window didn't go well. Now, he did say during that he was planning for the European Championship campaign 2024. Can you give any clarity as to where the FAI stand, how long his contract is? Have you looked beyond this current World Cup campaign?
Look, it's very simple and very clear. Stephen has a contract until the end of July 2022. In relation to the current campaign, we as a board review any international window at the end of that window. So on a monthly basis, we'll be looking at the overall World Cup qualification campaign in November. And as a board, we'll discuss all of the areas and all of the issues. Yeah, we'll be thinking about it in terms of our own strategy and our own medium-term strategy, etc., etc. But we'll have that conversation at that point.
Would you agree that some of the reports last week, or with the reports last week, that said that he's under pressure if he doesn't get results, if he doesn't get winning results?
Well, look, I think Stephen knows, and we talked about this earlier in our announcement of the Sky supporting the Irish women's national team. That we have an expectation before every game that we're going to be competitive and win those games. But football is football, and we've had a range of performances, we've had a range of results. And we will review those, as I say, as we move forward.
But does he need to win matches to keep his job beyond this current campaign?
As I say, I'm not going to have that type of conversation until we get to the end of the campaign itself.
Johnny Ward, fairly clear message there, which was the results have been mixed. We won't be considering anything about Stephen Kenny's future until these 4 games in October and November. And definitely no backing of his position currently from Jonathan Hill there.
Yeah, but he says it's clear and simple, but it's anything but. I mean, it's like Oscar Wilde, the truth is rarely pure and never simple. Nobody really, you know, could say after that highly kind of publicised chat that the various journalists had with Hill. What he said there was almost carbon copy of what I read in the in the print media, so he was obviously kind of sticking to a line.
He did four interviews, Johnny, and almost exactly the same line was used in each, because I watched the TV news on RT and Virgin Media on the same night, I think that was Thursday, and exactly the same line came in both.
Yeah, so it was an odd one, because you're thinking, what's Stephen Kenny thinking after this? Does he know more than we know and everything is grand, or is he thinking, oh, we're sort of screwed if we don't get results against Luxembourg and Azerbaijan, or is he like, I'll be grand? There's a lot to follow the theme of vagueness here. There's not much in the coverage about Stephen Kenny today. I think
there's a bit of Republic of Ireland fatigue maybe after the week, and particularly like I felt on Monday and Tuesday there was very strong coverage that there had to be a briefing somewhere, that three or four journalists had gone with the line that Stephen Kenny was under massive pressure if they lost against Serbia.
I don't know who's leaking this stuff, because you know I'd obviously close to Dan McDonnell.
Do you reckon it was leaked though?
I don't know. I don't know who's leaking. Is it a board member? Is it somebody else in the FAI? You know, there's a theory out there that there are various camps, and with that in mind, some of the stuff in the papers today was maybe tamer than I thought it might be. And you know, Shane McGrath has a piece in the Mail, which I think is quite fair, really. It's neither here nor there in terms of, oh, he has to get, you know, the Euros campaign, or he's been terrible. It's kind of, it assesses the fact that our results in general have been really, really poor. And Stephen Kenny has to reflect on the fact that, you know, we don't have a goal scorer, but more to the point, the goals we've been scoring of late have been basically borrowed from the old Ireland. I mean, hitting a fella's arse and scoring from a corner, and we haven't really been creating the chances that he'd like.
There was something very old school about Serbia. I was saying this to Jonathan Walters during the week, that Ireland lived a little bit by their luck. Goalkeeper makes some good saves, some good last-ditch defending, and then the last 10 minutes becomes, let's get the ball into the box and score. That could have been the Mick McCarthy or the Martin O'Neill playbook.
And more so even against Azerbaijan, where James McLean, I think, had more touches than any player on the pitch, which is not what we would ever want, really, because he's obviously one of our... He's a workhorse, but he doesn't have a lot of technical ability. But with that in mind, and what I'm talking about, the strikers... Paul McGrath speaks that Robbie and Stephen must sort things, and it's like this is just not going to happen. And Paul, who's probably my favourite footballer of all time in some respects, I got a lot of sick on Twitter last week after being too hard on Stephen at Strog in Azerbaijan, and this is the Sunday World, and he says it's high time now that somebody out at the FAI offices banged heads together and told Stephen Kenny and to take Robbie Keane onto his coaching staff. So there's
more chance of you and I being on the coaching staff, John, than that happens.
Yeah, and I think we do a good job, actually. But if we got as much time as Stephen Kenny, I think we'll likely get. Maybe we do okay, but there isn't really that much. I think there's, as you said, there's a bit of fatigue. It was almost discussed to death. But when you think, like, we've had this six-game window, and this is the first chance on a Sunday, and the Sunday papers should be a lot about reviewing and kind of erudite analysis or whatever, there really isn't much there. And a lot of it is speculation. Even Matt Cooper talks about... Matt Cooper made a... I'd argue a questionable point in the Sunday Business Post.
Back page of the Business Post, yeah.
Where he talks about Philip Brown is obviously leaving the IRFU, and the unpredictable nature of sport, and that, like, I imagine being CEO of the IRFU is an unbelievably good job to have and something you'd be very proud of. But because of the pandemic and all that, his successor is going to face a lot of problems. But he made a point that Stephen Kenny is only in the job basically, they can't sack him because they can't afford to sack him. I'm paraphrasing here, but I don't think that to be true, to be honest. Stephen Kenny is sort of taking a longer term view. Now, it's convenient for him to say that as well, in the sense that we've already been knocked out of this group, so it completely suits the narrative to say, well, to be honest, I was building for the Euros, which he clearly would not be saying if Ireland were top of the group, which they're not. So, and you have articles in during the week saying that the FAI would have to have chats with their commercial partners who backed them for this campaign because, well, we didn't know that Stephen Kenny was writing off the campaign. So it's an awful lot of nonsense as well.
The commercial partners would never have expected Ireland to qualify for the World Cup in Qatar.
No, if they did, they're idiots. Do you know what I mean? They're absolutely idiots. I mean, We are not doing well in this group on paper. We played very well against a bit of a ramshackle Portugal outfit, I thought, who were poor on the night, but we showed a lot of promise. We backed that up with a poor performance against Azerbaijan, and Paul McGrath is absolutely right. We need to be beating Azerbaijan. But personally, I'm in the camp that we need to take a longer-term view, but I don't think you'll be any wiser reading any of the papers, put it that way. Read the Kimmich piece, the stuff in Kenny, not so much.
All right. Tim, can I move you on to Cristiano Ronaldo? Because there's a lot of coverage about him, and there's a three-page spread effectively across the Sunday Times, and I think the way this is positioned is pretty interesting too, because on the one side you've got Paul Hurst's review of the game and Ronaldo's happy return and all the stats about how effective he was during the game in scoring the two goals, and ruthless Ronaldo lives up to the hype is the headline that they're using on page 9. But then across the way you've got Rebecca Meyer's piece, which is there, which is discussing the protest which took place before the game by Level Up, who got a plane and put a banner across in front of Old Trafford saying "Believe Catherine Mayorga." And for those who haven't been following the story, this goes back to a claim of rape against Ronaldo by Catherine Mayorga in Las Vegas in 2009. There were all sorts of issues around non-disclosure agreements, and Der Spiegel had put out some of the information around the police inquiries into it about a year or two ago. So this story has been kind of hanging over Cristiano Ronaldo for a while, but has emerged again because there's a civil case in the United States where currently Mayorga is looking to sue for damages civilly, not criminally, for $50 million. It's an intriguing little juxtaposition that we have, Tim, between the two stories here.
And then if you go to the next page, you have David Walsh also talking about Ronaldo. So it is fascinating. It's actually the highs and lows of Cristiano Ronaldo is captured in these sort of three pages. There's no doubts in that. From a footballing point of view, first, it's a great acquisition by United. I mean, he's a goal scorer. He's a phenomenal acquisition to get, he does what he does. He gets goals, and there's no doubt he'll be a big addition to this United team. So from a footballing point of view, you couldn't have written the script better. I mean, David Walsh makes it, I think, he talks about the biblical return of the prodigal son and fatted calves being killed and having to celebrate it in his piece. And he also talks about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer talking about it was a great goal, Ronaldo's first goal, it was a tap-in. So, you know, the emotions were very high, obviously, in a positive way in Old Trafford, just for Ronaldo. And he got two goals, United beat Newcastle comfortably. So, on the footballing side, it's the highs. There's no doubt about that, right? And then you contrast that. So when I was reading it, well, there's a contrast then with the low that is going on in his life with this rape allegation and the civil suit that's gone on in Las Vegas. And the fact that, you know, it's not been forgotten. And, you know, this plane flying over Old Trafford, just, you know, the prodigal son has returned. You know, Brian Robson made a point in one of the other papers about, you know, not since Eric Cantona came to United has there been such an atmosphere at a game. So the high for Ronaldo on his return, and then this protest, which is very interesting because the Rebecca Meyer's, the headline is, "We will not be silenced," the protesters are saying. So that would indicate that, you know, this is going to be an ongoing issue for Ronaldo at Old Trafford. United obviously say, the spokesman says, they can't comment on it in our piece. She did raise one interesting thing, though, about the Nike Twitter account, because there's a caption about and again and again and again and again, and they've obviously, you know, seen that in a very negative way in light of the allegation that's been made in Las Vegas. So I thought her piece was excellent. I just thought it was a very clinical piece. Okay, it was a very clinical piece of you know, her view on of the situation from that point of view, and taking in Level Up's protests and that. I thought that Paul Hurst was just, you know, basically talking about ruthless Ronaldo and the hype. But I like David Walsh's piece in the fact that, you know, it is up and away, but that's, you know, even Solskjaer is running away with the emotions and you know, over-enthusing about simple things. He's a great signing for United, but can he deal with this issue? Time will tell.
Yeah, David Walsh also makes the point that a lot of the Manchester United players look more comfortable having Ronaldo around, and I thought, particularly watching the game on Premier Sports yesterday, the second goal, Luke Shaw lays off a pass to Cristiano Ronaldo, which is never intended to create a goal chance, but just with the way that Cristiano is so single-minded about scoring goals, he bursts through the box and takes the shot, and it caught the Newcastle goalkeeper out. I think other forwards probably wouldn't have done the same.
Just briefly on that, yeah. Sorry, Well, I think it's significant that Rebecca Myers is a female journalist. I think the context of that shouldn't be overlooked here. It's a powerful piece. And in the context of the highly questionable Nike Twitter account, and again and again and again, that followed a few paragraphs previously, Newcastle fans began a chant of, "She said no," at points during the match. Ronaldo was quoted in legal documents published by German publication Der Spiegel as saying, "She said no and stopped several times about Mayorga on the night she claims he raped her." His legal team has claimed the documents are fake. So, you know, you can see why there would be an adverse reaction to that, and it's highly, highly questionable.
Yeah, and also not great opportunity yesterday that Ryan Giggs was in the director's box at Manchester United while there are charges against him potentially around domestic abuse, which I think will be heard in the new year. He, of course, disputes those claims, and Cristiano Ronaldo also says that he's not guilty of the accusations from 2009. Just jumping around a little bit, Tim, to Leona Maguire, because Dennis Walsh has got, I thought, a very good piece about Leona, who became the big star in the European team. You know, her rookie time to play in the Solheim Cup, her rookie year still on the LPGA Tour. She's been brilliant, but she was a huge star during the Solheim Cup. And he's written about the way that she got better even when the pressure was on against the Korda sisters last weekend.
I thought this was a superb piece. I just thought to myself, it captured Leona Maguire. You know, it talked about, you know, what she is. She seems to be gutsy. She seems to be, you know, have great courage. And as the pressure increased, I mean, look, she was 135 weeks or something as the number one amateur in the world. Like, she's, you know, she's a serious talent. And 15 years ago, she only took up golf. I thought that was fascinating. But the fact that when the pressure gets more intense, she seems to have the ability to perform better. And that's really something that is rare at the elite level in sport. Now, the question is, can she transfer that into the ladies event in the States next year? Because, you know, she hasn't won yet in that. You know, when you consider her amateur career was so successful. He also talked as well in the piece about the caddy, you know, who was Shane Lowry's former caddy. Yeah. And Dermot Bourne coming onto her bag, and that, you know, for a 3-week trial, and then obviously how it has, you know, been very successful. And then he talked about the coach, Shane O'Grady, the impact and the work that, you know, and the role he has had in building up Leona Maguire's success. But I thought, I watched the Solheim Cup last week, I thought she was a class act right throughout. I do believe if she would have had a fifth point, because Mel Reid didn't actually play too well in the game where they got a half point. So it was a phenomenal performance by her. It's definitely a breakthrough for her in the sense of, you know, putting her firmly, you know, in the radar now of the people at the top of the game in women's golf. And in the context of it, I just thought that David Walsh captured that. But he did talk about her pressure. He talked about her being gutsy. And McGinley made a point just at the top of that article as well about, he said, she's a seriously gutsy competitor, and anyone who followed her amateur career already knew that. I mean, I just think that, you know, the people are talking the right things for me when they talk about sports people having courage, having guts, and obviously then having the skill and ability to be able to perform when the pressure comes on, because that really what it's about at the top level, doing it when it matters. And she showed last week she can do it when it matters, despite the pressure.
And just a broader point about women's sport as well. I was on the train today coming back from Cork. So I was getting the train at 10:25, and there must have been 12 or 15 carriages. And I was like, what's going on here? It turns out the Cork Mogi team were on the train. So the train was absolutely full of male and female Cork Camogie fans. So that got me thinking about what I was told was the viewing figures for the Meath Dublin game, which were off the charts on RT. And then the Leona Maguire article, as Timmy says, beautiful article by Dennis Walsh, and I'm not really interested in golf, so I'm not really, like, I'll be honest with you, I read this piece because I'm on the paper review and it's like, well, let's read the Leona Maguire piece. But it's really, really interesting. But what I've noticed in recent times, first of all, is on the RT website after last weekend, and she absolutely dominated the most read.
But the top six stories were all female sport on Monday.
Top six, all female sport. You have then the following page, Davy Stockbrokers, which I've noticed of late, and I noticed this before now, has decided that it's going to back Leona Maguire. And actually, in light of the year that Davy has had, Leona was probably the one, or Davy are probably lucky to have her on board rather than the other way around. But Leona Maguire is there with Davy Stockbrokers, a star in the making in women's sport, and the Irish football team can't get a sponsor.
Yeah, men's team still struggling to get one. Skyrim with the women's team. Johnny Ward, thanks a million for joining us here in studio. Tim, joining us on Skype as well. Lads, have a good Sunday afternoon. Thanks a million for joining us.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.